Chapter 32. Note to readers. In Christian Bibles, chapter 32 begins with verse 2, and chapter 32 verse 1 is chapter 31 verse 55. Therefore, each verse in this chapter, following the Jewish enumeration of chapters, is one verse ahead of Christian Bibles. Thus, chapter 32 verse 2 here is chapter 32 verse 1 in Christian translations. Verse 1. Early in the morning, Laban kissed his sons and daughters and bade them goodbye. Then Laban left on his journey homeward. As Laban's adult sons, Genesis chapter 31 verse 1, are not going away with Jacob's family, his sons refers to his 11 grandsons. Laban kissed them and his daughters goodbye, but not Jacob, who is not even mentioned. Verse 2. Jacob went on his way, and angels of God encountered him. The Hebrew word used for angels, malachim, is the same word used for messengers in verse 4. Angels are God's messengers. Verse 3. When he saw them, Jacob said, "This is God's camp." So he named that place Mahanaim. Somehow Jacob understood these messengers were from God. Perhaps their presence was intended to mitigate, though it did not fully eliminate, Jacob's fear about his upcoming encounter with Esau. Mahanaim is a variation on the Hebrew word for camp, Mahane. Verse 4. Jacob sent messengers ahead to his brother Esau in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. The word used for messengers, malachim, is the same word used in verse 2 and previously for angels sent by God to communicate with humans. This is the first time in the Torah a human being is the one to send messengers, malachim. As a rule, when God sent malachim, we call them angels, and when human beings send them, we call them messengers. In both cases, they appear as humans. Verse 5, and instructed them as follows, "Thus shall you say, to my lord Esau." Hoping to ingratiate himself with Esau, who Jacob believed had been angry with him for 20 years, Jacob instructed the messengers to use deferential, even obsequious language. According to Nachmanides, Ramban, Jacob told his messengers to speak the way younger siblings spoke to older siblings in the ancient world. In that way, Jacob would publicly acknowledge Esau as his older brother. In the words of Nachmanides, "Now Jacob was showing Esau deference, as if that sale of the birthright meant nothing to him, and he was still acting toward Esau as the firstborn to remove the hatred from Esau's heart." Verse 5 continued, "Thus says your servant Jacob, I stayed with Laban and remained until now." Jacob explained why he did not try to make peace with his brother sooner. He was detained in Laban's home for 20 years. Verse 6, "I have acquired cattle, asses, sheep, and male and female slaves, and I send this message to my lord in the hope of gaining your favor." Jacob hoped to propitiate Esau by hinting that his possessions would be at Esau's disposal. Verse 7, the messengers returned to Jacob, saying, "We came to your brother Esau. He himself is coming to meet you, and there are 400 men with him." This constituted a sizable regiment in the ancient world. In chapter 14, Abraham went into battle with 318 men against a group of kings who kidnapped his nephew Lot. Verse 8, Jacob was greatly frightened. In his anxiety, he divided the people with him and the flocks and herds and camels into two camps. Verse 9, thinking, "If Esau comes to the one camp and attacks it, the other camp may yet escape." Verse 10, "Then Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, O Lord who said to me, return to your native land and I will deal bountifully with you. Jacob reminded God that returning to his native land, where his allegedly angry brother resided, was God's idea. Verse 11, I am unworthy of all the kindness that you have so steadfastly shown your servant. With my staff alone I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two camps. Everyone has crises of faith. Verse 12, deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau. Else I fear he may come and strike me down, mothers and children alike. Verse 13, yet you have said, I will deal bountifully with you and make your offspring as the sands of the sea, which are too numerous to count. God had long ago promised Jacob he would protect him, Genesis chapter 28, verse 15, and more recently that he would be with him. Why then did Jacob feel the need to plead to God for protection from Esau, and feel it necessary to remind God of his other promise, to give Jacob offspring too numerous to count? This is the Torah providing another example of the most devout individuals, even those who had direct contact with God, experiencing doubts. This is important for two reasons. First, it should comfort every one of us who ever has doubts. Given the nature of the world we inhabit, with its pain and suffering, the uncertainty engendered by an invisible God, and the knowledge of our mortality, doubts regarding God are entirely natural. Some people claim to never have doubts. I have to believe them, but I also have to believe they are rare. Second, it shows that even if God did appear to us, we would soon again have doubts. People imagine that God could make his existence so clear our faith would never again falter. As the case of Jacob makes clear, that is simply not so. In order for us to never doubt God, his existence, his goodness, or his trustworthiness, God would have to make his presence apparent at all times. But if God did that, the word faith would become meaningless. We would have virtually no free choice. Who would disobey God in his presence? Verse 14. After spending the night there, he selected from what was at hand these presents for his brother Esau. Jacob was so affluent he could gather together generous gifts from whatever happened to be most closely adjacent to him at the time. Verse 15. 200 she-goats and 20 he-goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams. Verse 16, 30 milch camels with their colts, 40 cows and 10 bulls, 20 she-asses and 10 he-asses. Verse 17, these he put in the charge of his servants, drove by drove, and he told his servants, go on ahead and keep a distance between droves. Verse 18, he instructed the one in front as follows. When my brother Esau meets you and asks you, whose man are you? Where are you going? And whose animals are these ahead of you? Verse 19, you shall answer, your servant Jacob's. They are a gift sent to my lord Esau, and Jacob himself is right behind us. Verse 20, he gave similar instructions to the second one, and the third, and all the others who followed the droves, namely, thus and so shall you say to Esau when you reach him. Verse 21, and you shall add, and your servant Jacob himself is right behind us. For he reasoned, if I propitiate him with presents in advance and then face him, perhaps he will show me favor. A strategic thinker, Jacob wanted to present these gifts to Esau in the most dramatic way possible. Instead of giving his brother everything at once, he instructed his servants to present the livestock in waves, one drove at a time, to gradually overwhelm Esau with his largesse and goodwill. Jacob may have taken advantage of his brother 2 decades before in wresting the birthright from him, but now he is more than willing to generously share the abundance of the Lord's blessings with Esau. Verse 22, and so the gift went on ahead while he remained in camp that night. Verse 23. That same night he arose, and taking his two wives, his two maidservants, and his 11 children, he crossed the ford of the Jabbok. In the ancient world, crossing a river was a monumental task, considered to be laden with significance. The Jabbok, thought to be the modern-day Zarqa River in what is now Jordan, is particularly challenging because it has steep banks on both sides. As regards the reference to Jacob's 11 children, the Torah previously recorded that at this point he had 12, 11 sons and a daughter. In light of the importance attached to sons at the time, his daughter Dinah is not mentioned. His 12th son, Benjamin, had not yet been born. To the modern reader, this ignoring of the daughter in the family count is troubling. But while reflecting the reality of the era in which its stories take place, the Torah and later books of the Bible prominently features women as important, sometimes even dominant, figures. Verse 24. After taking them across the stream, he set across all his possessions. Verse 25. Jacob was left alone. After getting his family to the other side, Jacob went back across the river to send everything else. That task completed, he remained alone, awaiting the encounter with his brother. Verse 25 continued, and a man wrestled with him until the break of dawn. In addition to the struggle with Esau that Jacob believed was coming, he now found himself struggling with a mysterious being at this sight. Verse 26. When he saw that he had not prevailed against him, he wrenched Jacob's hip at its socket, so that the socket of his hip was strained as he wrestled with him. Verse 27. Then he said, "Let me go, for dawn is breaking." But he answered, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." At some point, Jacob realized the being with whom he struggled was of divine origin and demanded from him a blessing. Verse 28, said the other, "What is your name?" He replied, "Jacob." Essay: The Meaning and Importance of the Name Israel, Struggle with God. Verse 29, said he, "Your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with beings divine and human, and have prevailed." It is almost impossible to overstate the importance of the meaning of the name Israel. It means struggle, Yisrah, with God, El. That God would bestow this name on his people could only mean God assumes, even expects, those who believe in him to struggle with him. There are believers who think struggle with God, such as questioning or even doubting God, is impious. But God assures us it is not only not impious, but expected, and it can be meritorious. Abraham, the first believer in this universal God, the first Jew, engaged in a prolonged and strongly worded struggle with God, Genesis chapter 18, verses 23 through 32. And God in no way even hinted it was wrong of Abraham to do so. Why did God create humans with the capacity to think, reason, and challenge if he did not want or expect them to use those God-given abilities in general and with regard to him? How could a thinking and feeling human being never struggle with God? How can one personally experience unjust suffering or observe the unjust suffering of others and not struggle with God or get frustrated or angry with God? The psalmist certainly does. "Why do you sleep, O Lord? Why do you hide your face, ignoring our affliction and distress?" Psalms 44, verses 24 through 25 Hebrew text, verses 23 through 24 Christian. By giving his chosen people the name struggle with God, in Genesis chapter 35, verse 10, it is God himself, not just the divine being of this chapter. God was not only giving people permission to struggle with him, he was actually asking us to. Doing so makes our faith authentic, And it is that authenticity which keeps us from turning into religious automatons. People who have no doubts about what they believe in, whether religious believers or believers in secular doctrines, easily become zealots who often do great harms. In the words of the late Immanuel Rachman, a prominent modern Orthodox rabbi, Judaism encourages doubt even as it enjoins faith and commitment. A Jew dare not live with absolute certainty, because certainty is the hallmark of the fanatic, and Judaism abhors fanaticism. And, because doubt is good for the human soul, it's humility. God had his own reasons for denying us certainty with regard to his existence and nature. One apparent reason is that man's certainty with regard to anything is poison to his soul. Who knows this better than moderns who have had to cope with dogmatic fascists, communists, and even scientists? Struggle means our relationship with God is real. Is there any person we love with whom we have never struggled? Why would it be different with God? Likewise, we all at some time struggle with our earthly father and mother. Why would we never struggle with our heavenly father? Many modern readers object to gender-based language in referring to God, such as Heavenly Father and He. See the essay Why God is Depicted in Male Terms in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. I will never forget paying a Shiva call, visiting a Jew during the seven-day mourning period, Shiva means seven, following the death of an immediate relative, to a young Chabad rabbi, who would be considered an ultra-Orthodox Jew. He had suddenly lost his wife, and he, along with their seven young children, was emotionally devastated. When I walked into his home, he looked at me, sighed, and cited a famous Yiddish lament, Man tracht und Gott lacht. Man plans and God laughs. This is an example of a pious person being real. The lament is a dark sentiment regarding God, but it in no way signified a diminution in the rabbi's faith in God. He was simply acknowledging the reality of struggle with God. He had God's permission, even invitation, to do so. At the same time, struggle with God also demands that non-believers struggle with their non-belief. The Torah is, in essence, telling any secular Jew who wishes to take being a Jew seriously that he too must struggle with God. He must struggle with his atheism or agnosticism and struggle to believe. To paraphrase Elie Wiesel, a Jew can love God or fight with God, but he cannot ignore God. The term secular Jew may need explanation. Many non-Jews find the term secular Jew or Jewish atheist difficult to comprehend. There is, for example, no such thing as a Christian atheist. That is because Christianity is a religion, not a people. A Christian, by definition, is a person who holds Christian beliefs. But a Jew is a Jew even if he is an atheist, because Jews are both a people and a religion. I suspect many more Jewish and Christian believers wrestle with faith than atheists wrestle with atheism. See the essay, Is It Okay for Believers to Have Doubts? At Genesis chapter 12, verse 12. That Israel means struggle with God is a distinguishing feature of Judaism and the Torah. This was illustrated in my early days of broadcasting when a Muslim woman called my radio show. She said, "You say we can ask you anything. Is that correct?" "Yes," I responded. "So, I would like to know, why aren't you a Muslim?" I told her I was honored by her call, by her belief that I had enough knowledge about Islam to give a thoughtful answer. She was aware I had studied Islam and Arabic. I responded, my answer lies in the words for each religion, Islam and Israel. Islam means submit to God, and Israel means struggle with God. I would rather struggle with God than submit to God. The woman contemplated that for a moment, then simply responded, "Thank you." I was touched by that woman. That is a believing Muslim she found the answer completely valid. Muslims are not taught to struggle with God. Nor, in my experience, are many Christians. Even though Genesis is as much a part of the Christian Bible as it is the Hebrew Bible. I am often surprised by how many Christians, many of whom know the Old Testament better than many religious Jews, do not know that Israel means struggle with God. To anyone seeking religious guidance, I believe just knowing the meaning of the word Israel should elicit intellectual respect for the Torah. No other religious book or secular doctrine demands its adherents struggle with it. Verse 30. Jacob asked, "Pray, tell me your name." But he said, "You must not ask my name," and he took leave of him there. The first thing humans want to know about strangers is who they are. Moses later asked God the same question at the burning bush. God offered only a terse and cryptic response, "I am what I am," Exodus chapter 3, verses 13 through 14. Man cannot know God's name because divinity is unknowable. As an anonymous medieval Hebrew philosopher put it, "Lu yudetiv hayitiv," if I knew God, I'd be God. Verse 31. So Jacob named the place Peniel, meaning, "I have seen a divine being face to face." Peniel literally means the face of God. The Hebrew here says God, Elohim, not divine being, as translated. Yet in the last chapter of the Torah, Deuteronomy chapter 34, verse 10, the Torah writes, "Never again did there arise in Israel a prophet like Moses, whom the Lord singled out face to face." How then did Jacob see God face to face? For one thing, Jacob did not see God face to face. Jacob saw a divine being. Hence the present translation, divine being. Second, it is Jacob who says he saw God face to face, not the Torah. From Jacob's perspective, the divine being was essentially God. Verse 31 continued, "Yet my life has been preserved." It is an innovation of the Torah that a person cannot see God and live. Exodus chapter 33, verse 20. Verse 32. The sun rose upon him as he passed Peniel. The Hebrew is Penuel and is the same place as Peniel. Verse 32 continued, limping on his hip. How to preserve national memory. Verse 33. That is why the children of Israel to this day do not eat the thigh muscle that is on the socket of the hip, since Jacob's hip socket was wrenched at the thigh muscle. To this day, kosher butchers remove the sciatic nerve from meat. This practice is an example of the centrality of physical signs and rituals in the Torah and in Jewish tradition. As I understand it, the Torah's laws, ritual and moral, have three primary purposes. Some of the laws fit into all three categories, but each fits into at least one. 1. To produce a moral individual. 2. To bring holiness into one's life. 3. To preserve Jewish national memory. The removal of the sciatic nerve falls into the third category. These laws of national memory are a major reason Jews, unlike other nations and religions from the ancient world, have survived for more than 3,000 years. A nation without a memory will cease to exist. As a general rule, the Torah believes people can best internalize a value or memory through physical representation. For instance, instead of just being told to remember they were slaves in Egypt, Jews are instructed to eat bread that has not risen, matzah, as the Israelites did when they fled Egypt for 7 days each year, Passover, and to observe a Passover Seder where they are to eat bitter herbs so as to remember the bitterness of slavery. The Torah and Judaism are behaviorist in their approach to life. How we behave is ultimately more important than how we think or feel. This is one of the greatest differences between the Torah and the contemporary mind, which attaches far more importance to how people feel. That the behavioral approach is superior should be obvious upon a moment's reflection. Do we care more about how people feel about us or how they treat us? Are the poor helped more by compassionate words or by compassionate deeds?